It was impossible for me to take a dark view too long. Somehow I was able to forget about myself for long stretches. I ate donuts for breakfast. I kept drinking very sweet, milky coffee. To lift my mood, I did things my parents wouldn't have let me do, ordering 2 and sometimes 3 desserts and never eating salads. I was free now to let my teeth rot or to put my feet up on the backs of seats. Sometimes, while I was hitching, I saw other runaways. Under overpasses or in runoff drains, they congregated smoking cigarettes, the hoods of their sweatshirts pulled up. They were tougher than I was, scroungier. I steered clear of their packs. They were from broken homes, had been physically abused and now abused others. I wasn't anything like them. I had brought my family's upward mobility out onto the road. I joined no packs, but went my way alone. And now, amid the prairie, appears the recreation vehicle belonging to Myron and Sylvia Bresnick of Pelham, New York. Like a modern-day covered wagon, it rolls out of the waving grasslands and stops. A door opens, like the door of a house, and standing inside is a perky woman in her late 60s. "I think we've got room for you," she says. A moment before, I'd been on Route 80 in western Iowa. But now, as I carry my suitcase onto this ship of the prairie, I am suddenly in the Bresnicks' living room. Framed photographs of their children hang on the walls, along with Chagall prints. The history of Winston Churchill, that Myron is working his way through at night at the hookups, sits on the coffee table. Myron is a retired parts salesman, Sylvia, a former social worker. In profile, she resembles a cute Punchinello, her cheeks expressive, painted, and the nose carved for comic effect. Myron works his lips around his cigar, foul and intimate with his own juices. While Myron drives, Sylvia gives me a tour of the beds, the shower, the living area. "What school do I go to? What do I want to be?" She peppers me with questions. Myron turns from the wheel and booms, "Stanford! Good school!" And it is right then that it happens. At some moment on Route 80, something clicks in my head, and suddenly I feel I am getting the hang of it. Myron and Sylvia are treating me like a son. Under this collective delusion, I become that, for a little while at least. I become male-identified. But something daughterly must cling to me, too, for soon Sylvia has taken me aside to complain about her husband. "I know it's tacky, this whole RV thing. You should see the people we meet in these camps. They call it the RV lifestyle. Oh, they're nice enough, but boring. I miss going to cultural events. Myron says he spent his life traveling around the country, too busy to see it. So he's doing it over again. Slowly. And guess who gets dragged along?"
"My heart," Myron is calling to her. "Could you bring your husband an iced tea, please? He's parched."
They let me off in Nebraska. I counted my money and found I had $230 left. I found a cheap room in a kind of boarding house and stayed the night. I was still too scared to hitchhike in the dark. On the road, there was time for minor adjustments. Many of the socks I'd brought were the wrong color, pink, white, or covered with whales. Also, my underpants weren't the right kind. At a Woolworth's in Nebraska City, I bought a 3-pack of boxer shorts. As a girl, I had worn size large. As a boy, medium. I trolled through the toiletry section, too. Instead of row upon row of beauty products, there was only a single rack of hygienic essentials. The explosion in men's cosmetics hadn't happened yet. There were no pampering unguents disguised by rugged names, no heavy-duty skin repair, no anti-burn shave gel. I selected deodorant, disposable razors, and shaving cream. The colorful cologne bottles attracted me, but my experience with aftershaves was not favorable. Cologne made me think of voice coaches, of maitre d's, of old men and their unwanted embraces. I picked out a man's wallet, too. At the register, I couldn't look the cashier in the face, as embarrassed as if I were buying condoms. The cashier wasn't much older than I was, with blonde feathered hair, that heartland look. At restaurants, I began to use the men's rooms. This was perhaps the hardest adjustment. I was scandalized by the filth of men's rooms, the rank smells and pig sounds, the grunting and huffing from the stalls. Urine was forever puddled on the floors. Scraps of soiled toilet paper adhered to the commodes. When you entered a stall, more often than not, a plumbing emergency greeted you. A brown tide, a soup of dead frogs. To think that a toilet stall had once been a haven for me. That was all over now. I could see at once that men's rooms, unlike the ladies, provided no comfort. Often there wasn't even a mirror or any hand soap. And while the closeted, flatulent men showed no shame, at the urinals, men acted nervous. They looked straight ahead like horses with blinders. I understood at those times what I was leaving behind. The solidarity of a shared biology. Women know what it means to have a body. They understand its difficulties and frailties, its glories and pleasures. Men think their bodies are theirs alone. They tend them in private, even in public. A word on penises. What was Cal's official position on penises? Among them, surrounded by them, his feelings were the same as they had been as a girl. By equal measures, fascinated and horrified. Penises had never really done that much for me. My girlfriends and I had a comical opinion of them. We hid our guilty interest by giggling or pretending disgust. Like every schoolgirl on a field trip, I'd had my blushing moments among the Roman antiquities. I'd stolen peeks when the teacher's back was turned. It's our first art lesson as kids, isn't it? The nudes are dressed. They're dressed in high-mindedness. Being 6 years older, my brother had never shared a bathtub with me. The glimpses of his genitals I'd had over the years were fleeting. I'd studiously looked away. Even Jerome had penetrated me without my seeing what went on. Anything so long concealed couldn't fail to intrigue me, but the glimpses those men's rooms afforded were on the whole disappointing. The proud phallus was nowhere in evidence. Only the feed bag, the dry tuber, the snail that had lost its shell. And I was scared to death of being caught looking. Despite my suit, my haircut, and my height, every time I went into a men's room, a shout rang out in my head, "You're in the men's!" But the men's was where I was supposed to be. Nobody said a word. Nobody objected to my presence. And so I searched for a stall that looked halfway clean. I had to sit to urinate. Still do. At night, on the fungal carpets of motel rooms, I did exercises, push-ups and sit-ups. Wearing nothing but my new boxers, I examined my physique in the mirror. Not long ago, I'd fretted over my failure to develop. That worry was gone now. I didn't have to live up to that standard anymore. The impossible demands had been removed, and I felt a vast relief. But there were also moments of dislocation, staring at my changing body. Sometimes it didn't feel like my own. It was hard, white, bony. Beautiful in its own way, I supposed, but Spartan, not receptive or pliant at all. Contents under pressure, rather. It was in those motel rooms that I learned about my new body, its specific instructions and contraindications. The object and I had worked in the dark. She had never really explored my apparatus much. The clinic had medicalized my genitals. During my time there, they were numb or slightly tender from the constant examinations. My body had shut down in order to get through the ordeal. But traveling woke it up. Alone, with the door locked and the chain on, I experimented with myself. I put pillows between my legs. I lay on top of them. Half paying attention while I watched Johnny Carson, my hand prospected. The anxiety I'd always felt about how I was made had kept me from exploring the way most kids did. So it was only now, lost to the world and everyone I knew, that I had the courage to try it out. I can't discount the importance of this. If I had doubts about my decision, if I sometimes thought about turning back, running back to my parents in the clinic and giving in, what stopped me was this private ecstasy between my legs. I knew it would be taken from me. I don't want to overestimate the sexual, but it was a powerful force for me, especially at 14, with my nerves bright and jangling, ready to launch into a symphony at the slightest provocation. That was how Cal discovered himself, in voluptuous, liquid, sterile culmination, couchant upon two or three deformed pillows, with the shades drawn and the drained swimming pool outside and the cars passing endlessly all night. Outside Nebraska City, a silver Nova hatchback pulled over. I ran up with my suitcase and opened the passenger door. At the wheel was a good-looking man in his early 30s. He wore a tweed coat and a yellow V-neck sweater. His plaid shirt was open at the collar, but the wings were crisp with starch. The formality of his clothes contrasted with his relaxed manner. "Hello there," he said, doing a Brooklyn accent. "Thanks for stopping." He lit a cigarette and introduced himself, extending his hand. "Ben Shear." "My name's Cal." He didn't ask the usual questions about my origin and destination. Instead, as we drove off, he asked, "Where'd you get that suit?"
"Salvation Army."
"Nice." "Really?" I said, and then reconsidered.
"You're teasing."
"No, I'm not," said Shear. "I like a suit somebody died in. It's very existential."
"What's that?"
"What's what?"
"Existential." He gave me a direct look.
"An existentialist is someone who lives for the moment."
No one had ever talked to me like this before. I liked it. As we drove on through the yellow country, Shear told me other interesting things. I learned about UNESCO and the Theater of the Absurd, also about Andy Warhol and the Velvet Underground. It's hard to express the excitement such phrases instilled in a kid like me from the cultural sticks. The charm bracelets wanted to pretend they were from the East, and I guess I had picked up that urge too.
"Did you ever live in New York?" I asked.
"Used to.
I was just there. I want to live there someday."
"I lived there 10 years.
"Why did you leave?"
Again, the direct look.
"I woke up one morning and realized if I didn't, I'd be dead in a year."
This, too, seemed marvelous. Shear's face was handsome, pale, with an Asiatic cast to his gray eyes. His light brown fizzy hair was scrupulously brushed and parted by fiat. After a while, I noticed other niceties of his dress. The monogram cufflinks, the Italian loafers. I liked him immediately. Shear was the kind of man I thought I would like to be myself. Suddenly, from the rear of the car, there erupted a magnificent, weary, soul-emptying sigh.
"How you doing, Franklin?"
Shear called. On hearing his name, Franklin lifted his troubled, regal head from the recesses of the hatchback, and I saw the black and white markings of an English setter. Ancient, roomy-eyed, he gave me the once-over and dropped back out of sight. Shear was meanwhile pulling off the highway. He had a breezy highway driving style, but when making any kind of maneuver, he snapped into military action, pummeling the wheel with strong hands. He pulled into the parking lot of the convenience store.
"Back in a minute."
Holding a cigarette at his hip like a riding crop, he walked with clipped steps into the store. While he was gone, I looked around the car. It was immaculately clean, the floor mats freshly vacuumed. The glove box contained orderly maps and tapes of Mabel Mercer. Shear reappeared with two full shopping bags.
"I think road drinks are in order," he said.
He had a 12-pack carton of beer, two bottles of Blue Nun, and a bottle of Lancer's Rosé in a faux clay bottle. He set all these on the back seat. This was part of being sophisticated, too. You drank cheap Liebfrau milk in plastic cups, calling it cocktails, and carved off hunks of cheddar cheese with a Swiss Army knife. Shear had assembled a nice hors d'oeuvre platter from meager sources. There were also olives. We headed back out across the no man's land while Shear directed me to open the wine and serve him snacks. I was now his page. He had put in the Mabel Mercer tape and then enlightened me about her meticulous phrasing. Suddenly he raised his voice.
"Cops, keep your glass down."
I quickly lowered my Blue Nun and we drove on, acting cool as the state trooper passed on our left. By now Shear was doing the cop's voice.
"I know city slickers when I see 'em, and them thar's two of the slickest of 'em all. I'd wager they're up to no good."
To all this I responded with laughter, happy to be in league against the world of hypocrites and rule-mongers. When it began to grow dark, Shear chose a steakhouse. I was worried it might be too expensive, but he told me, "Dinner's on me tonight." Inside, it was busy, a popular place, the only table open, a small one near the bar. To the waitress, Shear said,
I'll have a vodka martini, very dry, two olives, and my son here will have a beer."
The waitress looked at me.
"He got an ID?"
Not on me, I said.
"Can't serve you then."
"I was there at his birth. I can vouch for him," said Shear.
"Sorry, no ID, no alcohol."
"Okay, then," said Shear. "Change my mind.
I'll have a vodka martini, very dry, two olives, and a beer chaser.
Through her tight lips, the waitress said,
You gonna let your friend drink that beer? I can't serve it to you.
They're both for me, Shear assured her. He deepened his voice a little, opened the tone a little, injecting it with an Eastern or Ivy League authority whose influence did not entirely dissipate even all the way out here in the steakhouse on the plains.
The waitress, resentful, complied. She walked off, and Shear leaned toward me. He did his hick voice again.
Nothing wrong with that gal that a good poke in the hay barn wouldn't fix, and you're just the stud for the job.
He didn't seem drunk, but this crudeness was new. He was a little less precise in his movements now, his voice louder.
Yeah, said Shear. I think she's sweet on you. You and Mayella could be happy together.
I was feeling the wine strongly, too, my head like a mirrored ball flashing lights. The waitress brought the drinks, setting them demonstratively on Shear's side of the table. As soon as she disappeared, he pushed the beer toward me and said, There you go.
Thanks.
I drank the beer in gulps, pushing it back across the table whenever the waitress passed by. It was fun to be sneaking it like this.
But I was not unobserved. A man at the bar was watching me. Wearing a Hawaiian shirt and sunglasses, he looked as though he disapproved. But then his face broke into a big, knowing smile. The smile made me uncomfortable, and I looked away.
When we came out again, the sky was completely dark. Before leaving, Shear opened the hatch of the Nova to get Franklin out. The old dog could no longer walk, and Shear had to lift him bodily out of the car.
Let's go, Franks,
Shear said, gruffly affectionate, and with a lit cigarette between his teeth, angled up in a patrician manner not unlike that of Franklin Roosevelt himself, in Gucci loafers and side-vented, gold-hued tweed jacket, his strong polo player's legs braced under the weight, he carried the aged beast into the weeds. Before going back to the highway, he stopped at a convenience store to get more beer. We drove for another hour or so. Shear consumed many beers. I worked my way through one or two. I was not at all sober and feeling sleepy. I leaned against my door, blearily looking out. A long white car came alongside us. The driver looked at me, smiling. But I was already falling asleep. Sometime later, Shear shook me awake.
I'm too wrecked to drive. I'm pulling over.
I said nothing to this. I'm going to find a motel. I'll get you a room, too, on me.
I didn't object.
Soon I saw hazy motel lights. Shear left the car and returned with my room key. He led me to my room, carrying my suitcase, and opened the door for me. I went to the bed and collapsed. My head was spinning. I managed to pull down the bedspread and get at the pillows.
You gonna sleep in your clothes? Shear asked, as if amused.
I felt his hand on my back, rubbing it.
You shouldn't sleep in your clothes, he said.
He started to undress me. But I roused myself. Just let me sleep, I said. Shear bent closer. In a thick voice, he said, Your parents kick you out, Cal? Is that it? He sounded suddenly very drunk, as if all the days and nights drinking had finally hit him. I'm going to sleep, I said.
Come on, whispered Shear. Let me take care of you.
I curled up protectively, keeping my eyes closed. Shear nuzzled me, but when I didn't respond, he stopped. I heard him open the door and then close it behind him. When I woke again, it was early in the morning. Light was coming in the windows, and Shear was right next to me. He was hugging me clumsily, his eyes squeezed shut.
Just want to sleep here, he said, slurring. Just want to sleep.
My shirt had been unbuttoned. Shear was wearing only his underwear. The television was on, and there were empty beers on it. Shear clutched me, pressing his face into mine, making sounds. I tolerated this, feeling obliged for some reason. But when his drunken attentions became more avid, more targeted, I pushed him off me. He didn't protest. He crumpled into a ball and quickly passed out. I got up and went into the bathroom. For a long while, I sat on the toilet lid, hugging my knees. When I peeked out again, Shear was still sound asleep.
There was no lock on the door, but I was desperate for a shower. I took a quick one, keeping the curtain open and my eyes on the door. Then I changed into a new shirt, put my suit back on, and let myself out of the room. It was very early. No traffic was passing along the road. I walked away from the motel and sat on my Samsonite waiting. Big open sky, a few birds in it. I was hungry again. My head hurt. I got out my wallet and counted my dwindling money. I contemplated calling home for the 100th time. I started to cry, but stopped myself. Then I heard a car coming. From the motel parking lot, a white Lincoln Continental emerged. I put out my thumb. The car stopped alongside me, and the power window slowly went down. At the wheel was the man from the restaurant the day before.
"Where are you headed?"
"California." That smile again, like something bursting.
"Well then, this is your lucky day. That's where I'm headed too."
I hesitated only a moment. Then I opened the back door of the big car and slid my suitcase in. I didn't have, at that point, much choice in the matter. Ender Dysphoria in San Francisco. His name was Bob Presto. He had soft, white, fat hands and a plump face and wore a white Gallibero shot with gold threads. He was vain of his voice. He had been a radio announcer for many years before getting into his present line of business. What that was, he didn't specify. But its lucrative nature was evident in the white Continental with red leather seats and in Presto's gold watch and jeweled rings, his newscaster's hair. Despite these grown man touches, there was much of the mama's boy to Presto. He had the body of a little fatty, though he was big, close to 200 pounds. He reminded me of the big boy at the Elias Brothers chain of restaurants, only older, coarsened, and bloated by adult vices. Our conversation began the usual way, Presto asking me about myself and I giving the standard lies.
"Where are you off to in California?"
"College."
"What school?"
"Stanford."
"I'm impressed. I've got a brother-in-law went to Stanford. Big muckety-muck."
"Where is that again?"
"Stanford?" "Yeah. What city?"
"I forget."
"You forget? I thought Stanford students were supposed to be smart." "How are you going to get there if you don't know where it is?"
"I'm meeting my friend. He's got all the details and stuff."
"It's nice to have friends," Presto said. He turned and winked at me.
I didn't know how to interpret this wink. I kept quiet, staring forward at the road ahead. On the buffet-like front seat between us were many supplies, soft drink bottles and bags of chips and cookies. Presto offered me whatever I wanted. I was too hungry to refuse and took a few cookies, trying not to wolf them down.
"I'll tell you," Presto said, "the older I get, the younger college kids look. If you asked me, I'd say you were still in high school. What year are you in?"
"Freshman." Again, Presto's face broke into the candy apple grin.
"Oh, I wish I were in your shoes. College is the best time of life. I hope you're ready for all the girls."
A chuckle accompanied this, to which I was obliged to add one of my own.
"I had a lot of girlfriends in college, Cal," Presto said. "I worked for the college radio station. I used to get all kinds of free records. And if I liked a girl, I used to dedicate songs to her."
He gave me a sample of his style, crooning low.
"This one goes out to Jennifer, queen of Anthro 101. I'd like to study your culture, baby."
Presto's jowly head bowed and his eyebrows rose in modest recognition of his vocal gifts.
"Let me give you a little advice about women, Cal. Voice. Voice is a big turn-on for women. Never discount voice."
Presto's was indeed deep, dimorphically masculine. The fat of his throat increased its resonance, as he explained.
"Take my ex-wife, for example. When we first met, I could say anything to her, and she'd go bananas. We'd be fucking, and I'd say, 'English muffin,' and she'd come."
When I didn't reply, Presto said,
"I'm not offending you, am I? You're not one of those Mormon kids on your mission, are you? In that suit of yours?"
"No."
"Good. You had me worried for a minute. Let's hear your voice again," Presto said. "Come on. Give me your best shot."
"What do you want me to say?"
"Say, 'English muffin.'"
"English muffin."
"I don't work in radio anymore, Cal. I'm not a professional broadcaster. But my humble opinion is that you are not DJ material. What you've got is a thin tenor.
If you want to get laid, you better learn to sing.
He laughed, grinning at me. His eyes showed no merriment, however, but were hard, examining me closely. He drove one-handed, eating potato chips with the other.
Your voice has an unusual quality, actually. It's hard to place.
It seemed best to keep quiet.
How old are you, Cal?
I just told you.
No, you didn't.
I just turned 18.
How old do you think I am?
I don't know, 60?
Okay, you can get out now, 60. Ha! I'm 52, for Christ's sake.
I was going to say 50.
It's all this weight.
He was shaking his head.
I didn't look old until I gained all this weight. Skinny kid like you wouldn't know about that, would you? I thought you were a chick at first when I saw you standing by the road. I didn't register the suit. I just saw your outline, and I thought, Jesus, what's a young chick like that doing hitchhiking?
I was unable to meet Presto's gaze now. I was beginning to feel scared again and very uncomfortable.
That's when I recognized you. I saw you before, at that steakhouse. You were with that queer.
There was a pause.
I had him for a chicken hawk. Are you gay, Cal?
What?
You can tell me if you want. I'm not gay, but I've got nothing against it.
I'd like to get out now. Could you let me out? Presto let go of the wheel and held his palms up in the air.
I'm sorry. I apologize. No more third degree. I won't say another word.
Just let me out.
If that's what you want, okay. But it doesn't make sense. We're going the same way, Cal. I'll take you to San Francisco.
He didn't slow down, and I didn't ask him to. He was true to his word, and from then on remained mostly quiet, humming along to the radio. Every hour, he made a pit stop to relieve himself and to buy more economy-sized bottles of Pepsi, more chocolate chip cookies, more red licorice, and corn chips. Back on the road, he tanked up. He tilted his head back while he chewed, wary about getting crumbs on his shirt front. Soft drinks glugged down his throat. Our conversation remained general. We drove up through the Sierra, out of Nevada, and into California. We got lunch at a drive-thru. Presto paid for the hamburgers and milkshakes, and I decided he was all right, friendly enough, and not after anything physical from me.
Time for my pills, he said after we'd eaten. Cal, can you hand me my pill bottles? They're in the glove compartment.
There were five or six different bottles. I handed them to Presto, and he tried to read their labels, slanting his eyes.
Here, he said, steer for a minute.
I leaned over to take hold of the wheel closer to Bob Presto than I wanted to be, while he struggled with the caps and shook out pills.
My liver's all fucked up because of this hepatitis I picked up in Thailand. Fucking country almost killed me. He held up a blue pill. This is the one for the liver. I've got a blood thinner, too, and one for blood pressure. My blood's all fucked up. I'm not supposed to eat so much.
In this way, we drove all day, reaching San Francisco in the evening, when I saw the city, pink and white, a wedding cake arrayed on hills. A new anxiety took hold of me. All the way across the country, I had absorbed myself in reaching my destination. Now I was there, and I didn't know what I would do or how I would survive.
I'll drop you wherever you want, Presto said. You got an address where you're staying, Cal? Your friend's place?
Anywhere's fine.
I'll take you up to the Hate. That'll be a good place for you to get your bearings.
We drove into the city, and finally Bob Presto pulled his car over, and I opened my door. Thanks for the ride, I said.
Sure, sure, said Presto. He held out his hand. And by the way, it's Palo Alto.
What?
Stanford's in Palo Alto. You should get that straight if you want anyone to believe you're in college.
He waited for me to speak. Then, in a surprisingly tender voice, a professional trick too, no doubt, but not without effect, Presto asked,
Listen, guy, you got any place to stay?
Don't worry about me.
Can I ask you something, Cal? What are you, anyway?
Without answering, I got out of the car and opened the back door to get my suitcase. Presto turned around in his seat, a difficult maneuver for him. His voice remained soft, deep, fatherly.
Come on. I'm in the business. I might be able to help you out. You a tranny?
I'm going now.
Don't get offended. I know all about pre-op and post-op and all that stuff.
I don't know what you're talking about. I pulled my suitcase off the seat.
Hey, not so fast here. At least take my number. I could use a kid like you, whatever you are.
You need some money, don't you? You need an easy way to make some good money? You give your old friend Bob Presto a call.
I took the number to get rid of him. Then I turned and walked off as though I knew where I was going.
Watch out in the park at night, Presto called after me in his booming voice. Lot of lowlifes in there.
My mother used to say that the umbilical cord attaching her to her children had never been completely cut. As soon as Dr. Philippocian had severed the cord of flesh, another spiritual connection had grown up in its place. After I went missing, Tessie felt that this fanciful idea was truer than ever. In the nights, while she lay in bed waiting for the tranquilizers to take effect, she often put her hand to her navel like a fisherman checking his line. It seemed to Tessie that she felt something. Faint vibrations reached her. From these she could tell that I was still alive, though far away, hungry, and possibly unwell. All this came in a kind of singing along the invisible cord, a singing such as whales do, crying out to one another in the deep. For almost a week after I disappeared, my parents had remained at the Lockmore Hotel hoping I might return. Finally, the NYPD detective assigned to the case told them that the best thing to do was return home.
Your daughter might call, or turn up there. Kids usually do. If we find her, we'll let you know, believe me. The best thing to do is go home and stay by the phone.
Reluctantly, my parents took this advice. Before leaving, however, they had made an appointment with Dr. Luce.
A little knowledge is a dangerous thing, Dr. Luce told them, offering an explanation for my disappearance. Callie may have stolen a look at her file while I was out of my office, but she didn't understand what she was reading.
But what would make her run away? Tessie asked. Her eyes were wide, imploring.
She misconstrued the facts, Luce answered. She oversimplified them.
I'll be honest with you, Dr. Luce, said Milton. Our daughter called you a liar in that note she left. I'd like an explanation why she might say something like that.
Luce smiled tolerantly.
She's 14, distrustful of adults.
Can we take a look at that file?
It won't help you to see the file. Gender identity is very complex. It's not a matter of sheer genetics.
Neither is it a matter of purely environmental factors. Genes and environment come together at a critical moment. It's not difactorial. It's trifactorial.
Let me get one thing straight, Milton interrupted. Is it or is it not still your medical opinion that Callie should stay the way she is?
From the psychological assessment I was able to make during the brief time I treated Callie, I would say yes. My opinion is that she has a female gender identity.
Tessie's composure broke and she sounded frantic.
Why does she say she's a boy, then?
She never said that to me, said Luce. That's a new piece of the puzzle.
I want to see that file, demanded Milton.
I'm afraid that's not possible. The file is for my own private research purposes. You're free to see Callie's blood work and the other test results.
Milton exploded then, shouting, swearing at Dr. Luce.
I hold you responsible. You hear me? Our daughter isn't the kind to just run off like that. You must have done something to her, scared her.
Her situation scared her, Mr. Stephanides, said Luce. And let me emphasize something to you.
He rapped his knuckles against his desk.
It is of tantamount importance that you find her as soon as possible. The repercussions could be severe.
What are you saying?
Depression. Dysphoria. She's in a very delicate psychological state.
Tessie, Milton looked at his wife. You want to see the file? Or should we get out of here and let this bastard go screw himself?
I want to see the file. She was sniffing now. And watch your language, please. Let's try to be cordial.
Finally, Luce had given in and let them see it. After they had read the file, he offered to reevaluate my case at a future time and expressed hope that I would soon be found.
I'd never take Callie back to him in a million years, my mother said as they left.
I don't know what he did to upset Callie, said my father, but he did something.
They returned to Middlesex in late September. The leaves were falling from the elms, robbing the street of shelter. The weather began to turn colder, and from her bed at night, Tessie listened to the wind and the rustling leaves, wondering where I was sleeping and if I was safe. The tranquilizers didn't subdue her panic so much as displace it. Under their sedation, Tessie withdrew into an inner core of herself, a kind of viewing platform from which she could observe her anxiety. The fear, was a little less with her at those times. The pills made her mouth dry. They made her head feel as though it were wrapped in cotton and turned the periphery of her vision starry. She was supposed to take only one pill at a time, but she often took two. There was a place halfway between consciousness and unconsciousness where Tessie did her best thinking. During the day, she busied herself with company. People were constantly stopping by the house with food, and she had to set out trays and clean up after them. But in the nights, approaching stupefaction, she had the courage to try to come to terms with the note I'd left behind. It was impossible for my mother to think of me as anything but her daughter. Her thoughts went in the same circle again and again. With her eyes half open, Tessie gazed out across the dark bedroom, glinting and sparking in the corners, and saw before her all the items I had ever worn or possessed. They all seemed to be heaped at the foot of her bed. The beribboned socks, the dolls, the hair clips, the full set of Madeline books, the party dresses, the red Mary Janes, the jumpers, the easy bake oven, the hula hoop. These objects were the trail that led back to me. How could such a trail lead to a boy? And yet now apparently it did. Tessie went back over the events of the last year and a half, looking for signs she might have missed. It wasn't so different from what any mother would do confronted with a shocking revelation about her teenage daughter. If I had died of a drug overdose or joined a cult, my mother's thinking would have taken essentially the same form. The reappraisal was the same, but the questions were different. Was that why I was so tall? Did it explain why I hadn't gotten my period? She thought about our waxing appointments at the Golden Fleece and my husky alto, everything really. The way I never filled out dresses right, the way women's gloves no longer fit me, all the things Tessie had accepted as part of the awkward age suddenly seemed ominous to her. How could she not have known? She was my mother. She had given birth to me. She was closer to me than I was to myself. My pain was her pain, my joy her joy. But didn't Callie's face have a strange look sometimes, so intense? So masculine, and no fat on her, nowhere at all bones, no hips. But it wasn't possible. And Dr. Luce had said that Callie was a... And why hadn't he mentioned anything about chromosomes? And how could it be true? So ran my mother's thoughts as her mind darkened and the glinting stopped. And after she had thought all these things, Tessie thought about the object, about my close relationship with the object. She remembered that day when the girl had died during the play, recalled rushing backstage to find me, hugging the object, comforting her, stroking her hair, and the wild look on my face, not really sadness at all. From this last thought, Tessie turned back. Milton, on the other hand, didn't waste time reevaluating the evidence. On hotel stationery, Callie had proclaimed, "I am not a girl." But Callie was just a kid. What did she know? Kids said all kinds of crazy things. My father didn't understand what had made me flee my surgery. He couldn't fathom why I wouldn't want to be fixed, cured. And he was certain that speculating about my reasons for running away was beside the point. First, they had to find me. They had to get me back safe and sound. They could deal with the medical situation later. Milton now dedicated himself to that end. He spent much of every day on the phone, calling police departments across the country. He pestered the detective in New York, asking if there was any progress in my case. At the public library, he consulted telephone books, writing down the numbers and addresses of police departments and runaway shelters, and then he methodically went down this list, calling every number and asking if anyone had seen someone who fit my description. He sent my photograph to these police stations, and he sent a memo to his franchise operators, asking them to post my picture at every Hercules restaurant. Long before my naked body appeared in medical textbooks, my face appeared on bulletin boards in windows across the nation. The police station in San Francisco received one of the photographs, but there was little chance of my being recognized by it now. Like a real outlaw, I had already changed my appearance, and biology was perfecting my disguise day by day. Middlesex began to fill up with friends and relatives again. Aunt Zoe and our cousins came over to give my parents moral support. Peter Tatakis closed his chiropractic office early one day and drove in from Birmingham to have dinner with Milton Tessie. Jimmy and Phyllis Fioritos brought Kuluria and ice cream. It was as if the Cyprus invasion had never happened. The women congregated in the kitchen preparing food while the men sat in the living room conversing in low tones. Milton got the dusty bottles from the liquor cabinet. He removed the bottle of Crown Royal from its purple velvet sack and set it out for the guests. Our old backgammon set came out from under a stack of board games, and a few of the older women began to count their worry beads. Everyone knew that I had run away, but no one knew why. Privately, they said to each other, "Do you think she's pregnant?" And, "Did Callie have a boyfriend?" And, "She always seemed like a good kid. Never would have thought she'd pull something like this." And, "Always crowing about that kid with the straight A's at that hoity-toity school. Well, they're not crowing now." Father Mike held Tessie's hand as she lay suffering on the bed upstairs. Removing his jacket, wearing only his black short-sleeved shirt and collar, he told her that he would pray for my return. He advised Tessie to go to church and light a candle for me. I asked myself now what Father Mike's face looked like as he held my mother's hand in the master bedroom. Was there any hint of Schadenfreude, of taking pleasure in the unhappiness of his former fiancée, of enjoyment at the fact that his brother-in-law's money couldn't protect him from this misfortune, or of relief that for once on the ride home his wife Zoe wouldn't be able to compare him unfavorably with Milton? I can't answer these questions. As for my mother, she was tranquilized and remembers only that the pressure in her eyes made Father Mike's face appear oddly elongated, like a priest in a painting by El Greco. At night, Tessie slept fitfully. Panic kept waking her up. In the morning she made the bed, but after breakfast, sometimes went to lie on it again, leaving her tiny white kids neatly on the carpet and closing the shades. The sockets of her eyes darkened and the blue veins at her temples visibly throbbed. When the telephone rang, her head felt as if it would explode. "Hello?" "Any word?" It was Aunt Zoe. Tessie's heart sank. "No. Don't worry. She'll turn up." They spoke for a minute before Tessie said she had to go. "I shouldn't tie up the line." Every morning a great wall of fog descends upon the city of San Francisco. It begins far out at sea. It forms over the Farallones, covering the sea lions on their rocks, and then it sweeps onto Ocean Beach, filling the long green bowl of Golden Gate Park. The fog obscures the early morning joggers and the lone practitioners of Tai Chi. It mists up the windows of the glass pavilion. It creeps over the entire city, over the monuments and movie theaters, over the panhandle dope dens and the flop houses in the Tenderloin. The fog covers the pastel Victorian mansions in Pacific Heights and shrouds the rainbow-colored houses in the Haight. It walks up and down the twisting streets of Chinatown. It boards the cable cars, making their clanging bells sound like buoys. It climbs to the top of Coit Tower until you can't see it anymore. It moves in on the Mission, where the mariachi players are still asleep, and it bothers the tourists. The fog of San Francisco, that cold, identity-cleansing mist that rolls over the city every day, explains better than anything else why that city is what it is. After the Second World War, San Francisco was the main point of re-entry for sailors returning from the Pacific. Out at sea, many of these sailors had picked up amatory habits that were frowned upon back on dry land, so these sailors stayed in San Francisco, growing in number and attracting others until the city became the gay capital, the homosexual Hauptstadt. Further evidence of life's unpredictability. The Castro is a direct outcome of the military-industrial complex. It was the fog that appealed to those sailors because it lent the city the shifting, anonymous feeling of the sea, and in such anonymity, personal change was that much easier. Sometimes it was hard to tell whether the fog was rolling in over the city or whether the city was drifting out to meet it. Back in the 1940s, the fog hid what those sailors did from their fellow citizens, and the fog wasn't done. In the 50s, it filled the heads of the beats like the foam in their cappuccinos. In the 60s, it clouded the minds of the hippies like the pot smoke rising in their bongs. and in the 70s, when Cal Stefanides arrived, the fog was hiding my new friends and me in the park. On my third day in the Hate, I was in a cafe eating a banana split. It was my second. The kick of my new freedom was wearing off. Gorging on sweets didn't chase away the blues as it had a week earlier.
Spare some change?
I looked up. Slouching beside my small marble-top table was a type I knew well. It was one of the underpass kids, the scroungy runaways I kept my distance from. The hood of his sweatshirt was up, framing a flushed face ripe with pimples. Sorry, I said. The boy bent over, his face getting closer to mine.
Spare some change, he said again.
His persistence annoyed me, so I glowered at him and said, I should ask you the same question.
I'm not the one pigging out on a Sunday.
I told you I don't have any spare change. He glanced behind me and asked more affably,
How come you're carrying that humongous suitcase around?
That's my business.
I saw you yesterday with that thing.
I have enough money for this ice cream, but that's it.
Don't you have any place to stay?
I've got tons of places.
You buy me a burger, I'll show you a good place.
I said I've got tons.
I know a good place in the park.
I can go into the park myself. Anyone can go into the park.
Not if they don't want to get rolled, they can't. You don't know what's up, man. There's places in the gate that are safe and places that aren't. Me and my friends got a nice place, real secluded. Cops don't even know about it, so we can just party all the time. Might let you stay there, but first, I need that double cheese. It was a hamburger a minute ago. You snooze, you lose. Price has gone up all the time.
How old are you, anyway?
18? Yeah, right. Like, I'll believe that. You ain't no 18. I'm 16, and you're not any older than me. You from Marin?
I shook my head. It had been a while since I'd spoken to anyone my age. It felt good. It made me less lonely. But I still had my guard up.
You're a rich kid, though, right? Mr. Alligator.
I didn't say anything. And suddenly, he was all appeal, full of kid hungers, his knees shaking.
Come on, man, I'm hungry. Okay, forget the double cheese, just a burger.
All right.
Cool, a burger. And fries? You said fries, right? You won't believe this, man, but I got rich parents, too.
So began my time in Golden Gate Park. It turned out my new friend Matt wasn't lying about his parents. He was from the main line. His father was a divorce lawyer in Philadelphia. Matt was the fourth child, the youngest, stocky, with a lug's jaw, a throaty, smoke-roughened voice. He had left home to follow the Grateful Dead the summer before, but had never stopped. He sold tie-dye T-shirts at their concerts and dope or acid when he could. Deep in the park where he led me, I found his cohorts.
This is Cal, Matt told them. He's going to crash here for a while.
That's cool. You an Undertaker man? I thought it was Abe Lincoln at first.
Nah, these are just Cal's traveling clothes, Matt said. He's got some others in that suitcase, right?
I nodded.
You want to buy a shirt? I got some shirts.
All right. The camp was located in a grove of mimosa trees. The fuzzy red flowers on the branches were like pipe cleaners. Stretching over the dunes were huge evergreen bushes that formed natural huts. They were hollow inside, the soil dry underneath. The bushes kept the wind out and, most of the time, the rain. Inside, there was enough room to sit up. Each bush contained a few sleeping bags. You chose whichever one happened to be empty when you wanted to sleep. Communal ethics applied. Kids were always leaving the camp or showing up. It was equipped with all the stuff they abandoned. A camping stove, a pasta pot, miscellaneous silverware, jelly jar glasses, bedding, and a glow-in-the-dark frisbee the guys tossed around, sometimes enlisting me to even out the sides.
Jesus, Gator, you throw like a girl, man!
They were well-stocked with gorp, bongs, pipes, vials of amyl nitrate, but understocked on towels, underwear, toothpaste. There was a ditch, 30 or so yards distant, that we employed as a latrine. The fountain by the aquarium was good for washing oneself, but you had to do it at night to avoid the police. If one of the guys had a girlfriend, there would be a girl around for a while. I stayed away from them, feeling they might guess my secret. I was like an immigrant, putting on airs, who runs into someone from the old country. I didn't want to be found out, so remained tight-lipped. But I would have been laconic in that company in any case. They were all deadheads, and that was what the talk was. Who saw Jerry on which night? Who had a bootleg of which concert? Matt had flunked out of high school, but had an impressive mind when it came to cataloging dead trivia. He carried the dates and cities of their tour in his head. He knew the lyrics of every song, when and where the dead had played it, how many times, and what songs they had played only once. He lived in expectation of certain songs being performed, as the faithful await the Messiah. Someday the dead were going to play Cosmic Charlie, and Matt Larson wanted to be there to see creation redeemed. He had once met Mountain Girl, Jerry's wife. "She was so fucking cool," he said. "I would fucking love a woman like that. If I found a lady as cool as Mountain Girl, I'd marry her and have kids and all that shit like that." "Get a job, too?" "We could follow the tour. Keep our babies in little sacks, papoose style, and sell weed." We weren't the only ones living in the park. Occupying some dunes on the other side of the field were homeless guys with long beards, their faces brown from sun and dirt. They were known to ransack other people's camps, so we never left ours unattended. That was pretty much the only rule we had. Someone always had to stand guard. I hung around the deadheads because I was scared alone. My time on the road made me see the benefits of being in a pack. We had left home for different reasons. They weren't kids I would have ever have been friends with in normal circumstances, but for that brief time I made do, because I had nowhere else to go. I was never at ease around them, but they weren't especially cruel. Fights broke out when kids had been drinking, but the ethos was nonviolent. Everyone was reading Siddhartha. An old paperback got passed around the camp. I read it too. It's one of the things I remember most about that time. Cal sitting on a rock, reading Hermann Hesse and learning about the Buddha. "I heard the Buddha dropped acid," said one head. "That's what his enlightenment was." "They didn't have acid back then, man." "No, it was like, you know, a shroom." "I think Jerry's the Buddha, man." "Yeah. Like, when I fucking saw Jerry play that 45-minute Space Jam on Truckin' in Santa Fe, I knew he was the Buddha." In all these conversations, I took no part. See Cal in the far underhang of the bushes as all the deadheads drift off to sleep. I had run away without thinking what my life would be like. I had fled without having anywhere to run to. Now I was dirty, I was running out of money. Sooner or later, I would have to call my parents. But for the first time in my life, I knew that there was nothing they could do to help me. Nothing anyone could do. Every day, I took the band to Alibaba's and bought them veggie burgers for 75 cents each. I opted out on the begging and the dope dealing. Mostly, I hung around the mimosa grove in growing despair. A few times, I walked out to the beach to sit by the sea. But after a while, I stopped doing that, too. Nature brought no relief. Outside had ended. There was nowhere to go that wouldn't be me. It was the opposite for my parents. Wherever they went, whatever they did, what greeted them was my absence. After the third week of my vanishing, friends and relatives stopped coming over to Middlesex in such numbers. The house got quieter, the phone didn't ring. Milton called Chapter 11, who was now living in the Upper Peninsula, and said, "Your mother's gone through a rough period. We still don't know where your sister is. I'm sure your mother would feel a little better if she could see you. Why don't you come down for the weekend?" Milton didn't mention anything about my note. Throughout my time at the clinic, he had kept Chapter 11 apprised of the situation in only the simplest terms. Chapter 11 heard the seriousness in Milton's voice and agreed to start coming down on weekends and staying in his old bedroom. Gradually, he learned the details of my condition, reacting to them in a milder way than my parents had, which allowed them, or at least Tessie, to begin to accept the new reality. It was during those weekends that Milton, desperate to cement his restored relationship with his son, urged him once again to go into the family business.
"You're not still going with that Meg, are you?"
"No."
"Well, you dropped out of your engineering studies. So what are you doing now? Your mother and I don't have a very clear idea of your life up there in Marquette."
"I work in a bar."
"You work in a bar? Doing what?" short-order cook. Milton paused only a moment. What would you rather do, stay behind the grill or run Hercules hot dogs someday? You're the one that invented them anyway. Chapter 11 did not say yes, but he did not say no. He had once been a science geek, but the 60s had changed that. Under the imperatives of that decade, Chapter 11 had become a lacto-vegetarian, a transcendental meditation student, a chewer of peyote buttons. Once, long ago, he had sawed golf balls in half trying to find out what was inside, but at some point in his life, my brother had become fascinated with the interior of the mind. Convinced of the essential uselessness of formalized education, he had retreated from civilization. Both of us had our moments of getting back to nature, Chapter 11 in the UP, and me in my bush in Golden Gate Park. By the time my father made his offer, however, Chapter 11 had begun to tire of the woods. Come on, Milton said. Let's go have a Hercules right now. I don't eat meat, Chapter 11 said. How can I run the place if I don't eat meat? I've been thinking about putting in salad bars, said Milton. A lot of people eating a low-fat diet these days. Good idea. Yeah? You think so? That can be your department, then. Milton elbowed Chapter 11, kidding. We'll start you off as vice president in charge of salad bars. They drove to the Hercules downtown. It was busy when they arrived. Milton greeted the manager, Gus Zaras. Yasu! Gus looked up and, a second late, began to smile broadly.
Hey there, Milt! How you doing?
Fine, fine. I brought the future boss down to see the place, he indicated Chapter 11.
Welcome to the family dynasty, Gus joked, spreading his arms.
He laughed too loudly. Seeming to realize this, he stopped. There was an awkward silence. Then Gus asked,
So, Milt, what'll it be?
Two with everything. And what do we got that's vegetarian?
We got bean soup.
Okay, get my kid here a bowl of bean soup.
You got it.
Milton and Chapter 11 chose stools and waited to be served. After another long silence, Milton said, You know how many of these places your old man owns right now?
How many? Said Chapter 11.
66, got 8 in Florida. That was as far as the hard sell went. Milton ate his Hercules hot dogs in silence. He knew perfectly well why Gus was acting so over-friendly. It was because he was thinking what everyone thinks when a girl disappears. He was thinking the worst. There were moments when Milton did too. He didn't admit it to anyone. He didn't admit it to himself. But whenever Tessie spoke about the umbilical cord, when she claimed that she could still feel me out there somewhere, Milton found himself wanting to believe her. One Sunday, as Tessie left for church, Milton handed her a large bill.
Light a candle for Callie. Get a bunch. He shrugged. Couldn't hurt.
But after she was gone, he shook his head.
What's the matter with me? Lighting candles? Christ! He was furious at himself for giving in to such superstition.
He vowed again that he would find me. He would get me back somehow or other. A chance would come his way, and when it did, Milton Stephanides wouldn't miss it. The debt came to Berkeley. Matt and the other kids trooped off to the concert. I was given the job to look after the camp. It is midnight in the Mimosa Grove. I awaken, hearing noises. Lights are moving through the bushes. Voices are murmuring. The leaves over my head turn white, and I can see the scaffolding of branches. Light speckles the ground, my body, my face. In the next second, a flashlight comes blazing through the opening in my lair. The men are on me at once. One shines his flashlight in my face as the other jumps onto my chest, pinning my arms.
"Rise and shine," says the one with the flashlight.
It is two homeless guys from the dunes opposite. While the one sits on top of me, the other begins searching the camp.
What kind of goodies you little fuckers got in here?
Look at him, says the other. Little fucker's gonna shit his pants.
I squeeze my legs together, the girlish fear still operating in me. They are looking for drugs mainly. The one with the flashlight shakes out the sleeping bags and searches my suitcase. After a while, he comes back and gets down on one knee.
Where are all your friends, man? They go off and leave you all alone?
He has begun to go through my pockets. Soon he finds my wallet and empties it. As he does, my school ID falls out. He shines the flashlight on it.
What's this? Your girlfriend?
He stares at the photo, grinning.
Your girlfriend like to suck cock? I bet she does.
He picks up the ID and holds it over the front of his pants, thrusting his hips.
Oh, yeah, she does. Let me see that, says the one on top of me.
The guy with the flashlight tosses the ID onto my chest. The guy pinning me lowers his face close to mine and says in a deep voice,
don't you move, motherfucker.
He lets go of my arms and picks up the ID.